An interview would be work. Mitty wanted less work, not more. Plus, he was going to a college library with Olivia this afternoon, which was all the work anybody could ask of a person.
"Wouldn't interviews make your report awfully long?" said Eve, who was doing yellow fever. "It's already such a burden, Mr. Lynch."
"I'm teaching you to be thorough," said Mr. Lynch. "I yearn to discover upon reading your papers that one of you really was thorough."
"Probably Mitty," said Derek, and the whole class burst into laughter. When school was over, Mitchell John Blake and Olivia Clark took the subway uptown. It wasn't rush hour, and the train was largely empty. They not only got seats, they sat next to each other, and Mitty, whose hand was bare, held Olivia's hand, which was encased in a mitten so thick and woolly he couldn't tell it was even in there. Around 125th Street, she took the mitten off, and they twined fingers. When they got off at 168th, Mitty looked around with interest. He had never been up here where New York Presbyterian Hospital was. In spite of the bitter weather, the streets were packed with food vendors. Every mobile patient, visitor, employee, student, and doctor was in line buying every conceivable sidewalk food. Bagels and falafel, hot dogs and muffins, lattes, and soft pretzels. Mitty wanted to linger and buy some of each, but Olivia strode purposefully toward the health sciences library. Sure enough, they just walked in, and she trotted down the wide open stairwell to the stacks. Mitty disliked the sight of a jillion books he did not want to read, but Olivia was energized. All study carols seemed to be for individuals. Mitty said if they had to do this, they were sitting together. By the time he located a double carol, Olivia had vanished, presumably to accumulate Typhoid Mary material. Sighing, Mitty went off to find a dedicated terminal. He hit subject, typed in smallpox, and began jotting down book numbers. He was startled to find the title A Handbook for Medical Responders, 2003, listed under smallpox. Why would a book like that even mention smallpox? Your average ambulance driver didn't need to know what smallpox was like. Your extraordinary ambulance driver didn't need to know. Even ambulance drivers in Sudan didn't need to know. He went straight to that book, or as straight as he could, considering there were a million books and he couldn't figure out what order they were in. Smallpox, the book announced, had no known treatment. Mitty imagined emergency technicians seeing a rash, whipping out their handbooks, checking smallpox in the index, and then the instructions, "Give it up, you're dead." He wandered around, collecting his other titles. Now and then he spotted Olivia. Soon he had even more useless information. Abe Lincoln, in November of 1863, had a light case of smallpox and recovered. Mozart had smallpox at age 9, and his eyes were swollen shut for more than a week. Just prior to the Pilgrims' landing at Plymouth Rock, native tribes in Massachusetts caught smallpox from European traders. 9/10 of them died between 1616 and 1619, so when the Pilgrims showed up in 1620, only 10% of the Indians were left alive to say hello. Cotton Mather and Ben Franklin were the big movers coaxing Americans to get inoculated after the practice was invented in the 1700s. In a 1918 epidemic, 400,000 people in Russia and Poland died of smallpox. Then suddenly, Mitty found his epidemic. 1902, in Boston, just like the label on the envelope. There had been 1,024 cases of variola major, and 190 deaths. But how could there have been an epidemic in either 1902 or 1918? Inoculation had already been invented. Everybody should have been safe. Maybe they just hadn't felt like getting inoculated. Forgot. Were too busy. Didn't like shots. Mitty imagined some poor dudes in Boston lying on a bed, waiting their turn to die in agony and thinking, "Rats! Knew I should have gotten that shot." Boston's smallpox hospital had been at 112 Southampton Street. If Mitty had lived in Boston, he'd have gone there and photographed the site just to get away from all these books. Olivia showed up with a back-breaking stack and handed four to Mitty. Glumly, he read up on the topic she'd chosen for him, the eradication of smallpox. Then he plugged in his laptop and wrote, In 1965, an American guy named Donald Henderson got put in charge of a World Health Organization program to eradicate smallpox. It was the Russians asking for this, and it was President Lyndon B. Johnson who funded it. The president told Henderson's team they had 10 years to get rid of smallpox. It would be the first time in the history of the world that people actually got rid of a disease for good. Since smallpox virus lives only in human beings, the team didn't have to worry about controlling rats or mosquitoes or keeping the water supply clean or anything. Henderson had this brilliant idea. Every time there was a smallpox outbreak, he and his guys would race there at top speed and start giving everybody shots. They'd immunize every single solitary person in a huge area around the sick guys, making an immunized circle that could be miles around. He called it ring immunization. They wouldn't let anybody leave the ring until the infection time expired. That way, the circle would create a sort of wall that the virus would bump into. In India, Henderson's guys, he had 10,000 workers, called at every single solitary house in the entire country once a month to see if anybody had smallpox. They really and truly knocked on the doors of 120 million houses. By 1974, practically the whole world didn't have smallpox anymore because ring immunization worked. Only Bangladesh still had smallpox. The team went crazy immunizing people in Bangladesh, and by November of 1975, smallpox was whipped. Only one or two cases ever happened after that, and for those, the World Health Organization organized to the max and ringed each case with, no lie, 50,000 vaccinations. By October 1977, smallpox, the worst scourge known on Earth, is gone forever. He was delighted that he had managed to wedge scourge into his report, because it was a big word in smallpox circles. October 1977. Ages ago. His mother had been in high school, his dad in college. 70s music had lasted, though. Sometimes he even listened to it. Smallpox history did involve a hero, Donald Henderson, and a heroic act, getting rid of smallpox, and Mitty liked heroes. But he didn't want to read another word about anything, never mind this disgusting disease. Just when he thought she might be ready to leave, Olivia delved into her book bag and pulled out a book of her own. It was thin and early elementary school looking. "It's my beginner virus book," she said to him. "I know you weren't listening during class. I can always tell when you're listening to your iPod. I don't think our text does a good job of explaining what a virus actually is, so..." Mitty howled with laughter. Olivia blushed. "Okay, I'm sorry. This is the kind of pushy thing that makes Derek hate my guts."
"I love your guts," said Mitty, still laughing.
"Who else at St. Raphael's, who else in New York City, the world even, would give a guy a beginner book on viruses?" He took the book. Inside the cover, she had once written her name in big, fat, little kid script. Bunny Clark.
"Your nickname was Bunny?" he said incredulously. "You? Olivia? You used to be all floppy-eared and soft and hoppy?"
Olivia snatched the book back. She slammed it shut and flung it into her book bag.
"I forgot I wrote in there. Don't even think that word. Don't say it out loud again. Don't remember it."
Mitty nodded. "Not remembering and not thinking are primo with me." But he would never forget. It was no small step from Bunny to Olivia. She had reconfigured herself. Maybe the trick to maturity was to scrap the nickname. If he dropped Mitty and became Mitchell. Except that as Mitty, he had been a pretty decent student up until this year. This year was a serious slump. But it was so much more fun slumping than studying. Olivia recovered.
"Did you write anything?" she asked, nodding her chin at his laptop.
"Some."
"Mitty, if you don't get a C on this paper, you'll be below the grade level allowed. You'll get put back into regular biology."
"It wouldn't be a national emergency," Mitty pointed out.
"It would be for me."
The study carrels around them were empty. The whole floor was empty. Mitty pulled Olivia into his lap. It was now more than 48 hours since Mitty Blake had breathed in the particles of a smallpox scab. And Mitty, like the victims in the smallpox hospitals in 1902, had not been vaccinated. Chapter 4 That evening, Mindy's parents were planning to head over to their gym. They loved to work out. Mindy usually went along because he loved weightlifting and because afterward they'd go out for great food, or at least he and his dad would. His mom usually had non-food, like a green salad, without dressing. "Not tonight," he told his parents. "I have homework." Mindy was going to study. They practically danced out of the apartment. Of course, normally, when Mindy said, "I have homework," that was all he meant. He didn't mean, "And now I'm going to do it." Normally, when Mindy had homework, he watched television while his books mellowed in his backpack. But tonight, he actually itched to be done with his paper. It was a strange, dry-mouthed need. He was fidgeting inside his body, as if his bones wanted to shift some interior burden. The floor of his bedroom had become a debris field of smallpox papers and books. He had to get this stuff out of his life. Summoning up everything he'd read during his library imprisonment, he plunged into the next required topic. The reason anybody cares about smallpox today is that back when it was dangerous and it was everywhere all the time, the invention of vaccination happened because of smallpox. In 1796, there was this man in England named Edward Jenner. Back then, everybody knew that if you lived through smallpox, you never got it again. But Jenner noticed that some people never got smallpox to start with. Those people were girls who took care of cows. These girls were not called cowgirls, but dairymaids. The dairymaids caught a cow sickness called cowpox, which protected them from getting any other pox, including smallpox. Edward Jenner decided to do a test. Nobody would let you do it today. Jenner took this dairymaid, who had an open cowpox sore on her hand, and it was oozing cowpox yuck. Then he had this little boy, James Phipps, who I haven't found out yet if the mother and father said yes, but anyway, Jenner scraped open this poor little kid's arm and rubbed cowpox ooze into the wound and watched the kid get sick. He wasn't that worried because it was cowpox, which is not a disease you die of, just one nobody wants. The weeks go by. If cowpox is going to provide the kid with protection against smallpox, it's happened or it hasn't. Jenner slices open the kid's arm again and rubs real smallpox gunk into the cut and stands around waiting to see if the kid dies. This kind of test is called a challenge. Today it would be called grounds for a lawsuit. The boy doesn't get smallpox. Since smallpox is the world's most infectious disease and Jenner has just figured out how to stop it, it's a big deal. The only thing left is to convince everybody in the entire world to get their arms scraped like the kid, but people don't believe it works, and they're scared and think maybe God will disapprove if they go and change their bodies so they won't do it. Or sometimes an entire country doesn't even get the news about vaccination for a century or two, or they can't afford it or whatever. So generations go by, and still, even when the procedure is easier, not everybody gets vaccinated. Even today, there are people who won't vaccinate their kids against a disease because they feel the body you were born with shouldn't be changed, even if it saves your life, even if it's your own kid. The word vaccination comes out of the whole thing with the cow. They used Latin for science then, and the Latin word for cow is vacus. Mindy read what he had written and was satisfied, except for one thing. Somehow, he had moved into the present tense. He went back over his paragraphs and made everything past tense. Now for some television. Something that would capture him completely, so he could stop thinking about this rotten disease. Since Mindy did not have one molecule of neatness in his genetic makeup, he was amazed, prior to picking up the remote, to find himself carefully closing and putting away his books, as if also to close the book on the horror of smallpox. He noticed for the first time that his old books were illustrated. Back then, a photograph could be printed just on one side of special paper, so the books had all their photographs at the end. In principles, was a grainy black-and-white photo of a cowpox sore on a dairymaid's hand. The sore was an open ulcer the size of a quarter. It was sickening. Mindy could practically smell the rotting flesh, the stench of the pus. It didn't look as if it could heal at all, and it didn't look as if it would leave a scar. It looked as if it would leave a crater. This was cowpox? The boring one? The one that didn't kill you? Infectious Disease had 4 photographs of smallpox victims, their bodies so damaged that the patients looked like wizened dolls covered with black marbles. Even their eyelids and the insides of their mouths, the soles of their feet, and the palms of their hands were coated with dark, oozing pellets. One head was so swollen that Mitty knew it was a head only because it sat on shoulders. A hand consisted of little sticks covered with black blisters, fingers held apart, as if letting the pustules touch would be agonizing. Mitty could watch any movie with any amount of violence and gore and not flinch, but these creatures, who had once been human, he did not want to imagine the suffering they had gone through. He went online for color photographs. Everything seemed to be from Africa and Southeast Asia, where smallpox had lingered longest. Now he saw his first photographs of people who had survived the disease. The damage to their faces was horrifying. It wasn't as if they'd had a little acne. It was as if their faces had exploded and then sealed over. How come people called it smallpox? Was there a disease with bigger, worse pox? Mitty found nothing online, but got the answer in a minute in one of the old books. Syphilis was nicknamed Great Pox. He had a brief moment of scientific curiosity. He would research syphilis and see what its poxes looked like. Then he got a grip on himself and went out for hot dogs. Gray's Papaya was just down the street. This was a very specialized place. Weird fruit drinks and great hot dogs, which you bought in pairs. Mitty ate his first standing on the street corner watching fire engines and dog walkers. A little kid had a tantrum because his mother wouldn't buy him something or other, and a grungy old guy fished a discarded New York Post out of the trash. And a beautiful person, the famous kind with capital letters, the kind somebody who never missed an issue of People would recognize, strode by on amazingly high heels. Mitty had a sudden vision of these people catching smallpox. It was a while before he could go on to his second hot dog. His throat was all tight or something. He had planned to buy 2 more hot dogs to eat later while he watched TV, but his stomach was churning. He walked home slowly. The tape of Beowulf was still in the VCR. He rewound it, since he'd slept through it the last time, and decided to read along with the movie from his classroom copy of the book. He fanned Beowulf's pages and caught a line about Grendel, the monster Beowulf must destroy. Greedy and grim, he grabbed 30 men from their resting places and rushed to his lair, flushed up and inflamed from the raid, blundering back with the butchered corpses. Mitty loved when they ran around with butchered corpses. But once again, the movie played to itself, while Mitty actually continued to read. The insane monsters and valiant princes of Beowulf, and the strange rhythms and words of the poem gripped even Mitty. But the monster in Mitty Blake's life was not Grendel. Chapter 5. Wednesday morning, February 4. Mitty hadn't slept well. This had never happened to him before. No wonder drug companies made big money treating insomnia. Who wanted to lose sleep more than one night in a lifetime? For breakfast, he went to a diner for freshly squeezed orange juice. Then he ran all the way to school so the orange juice would slosh around inside and wake him up. The first person he saw in the foyer was Olivia. He barely had time to smile before she thrust yet another book into his face. She was as pleased with her gift as if she'd gotten him tickets for the NCAA playoffs. On the cover of this fat paperback was a cartoon of Revolutionary War soldiers marching away from an armed skeleton. Even Mitty recognized the Grim Reaper. The title was Pox Americana, the Great Smallpox Epidemic of 1775 to 82. "Don't look so panicky," said Olivia. "I put post-its on the good pages. Skip the rest." She gave him the beautiful smile that always made him reconsider everything in life, and trotted off to her first class.
"How can you stand her?" muttered Derek. "She's out buying your books for you and pasting them full of little reminders. Think about this, Mitty. What's next, marriage?"
Mitty just laughed. "So how's anthrax?" he asked, opening to Olivia's first post-it. She had highlighted a sentence that read, "Variola consumes its human host as a fire consumes its fuel."
Nice. Your skin bubbled up on the outside while you boiled to death on the inside. In spite of the orange juice, Mitty's mouth felt dry and uncomfortable. While Derek talked, Mitty drank from the hall water cooler. Maybe he should start carrying water bottles with him, like some kind of nerd. In English, Mrs. Abrams was back, so at last they had their Beowulf quiz. Mitty generally finished English tests quickly because he had so little to say. This time he finished quickly because he had so much to say. It flowed from his pen, as if he had known the questions last night, as if in his failure to sleep he'd been composing essays about monsters. When he handed in the quiz, he was startled to receive a library pass in exchange. Mrs. Abrams was used to blank looks on boys.
"To work on your research paper," she reminded him.
Mitty had not realized that Mr. Lynch and Mrs. Abrams were working together. How depressing. And then, when he reached the school library, didn't the librarian trot up with her book offering? Scourge, The Once and Future Threat of Smallpox, by Jonathan B. Tucker. These were the opening lines. In a maximum security facility in Atlanta, the world's most dangerous prisoner sits in solitary confinement, awaiting execution. Wanted for the torture and death of millions of people, this mass murderer was captured in a global dragnet lasting more than a decade. The world's most dangerous prisoner is the smallpox virus, and it is held inside two padlocked freezers in a secure room at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. Some 450 samples of the virus in neatly labeled half-inch plastic vials are arrayed on metal racks and immersed in a steaming bath of liquid nitrogen that keeps them deep frozen. Access to the smallpox repository requires two keys controlled by different people, and armed security guards, closed-circuit television cameras, and electronic alarm systems maintain continuous surveillance. A second set of smallpox virus stocks lie in a similar secure vault at a Russian laboratory in Siberia. And in spite of all that, the author actually titled his book The Future Threat of Smallpox? What future? A bioterrorist future? Did this guy actually picture 19 crazy Al-Qaeda thugs, having been foiled from boarding a plane, storming the CDC deep freeze, bypassing keys, armed guards, and alarm systems, sticking their little hands into liquid nitrogen, and rushing triumphantly away with their little vials of virus? Who exactly would agree to do that chore? It was one thing to be a suicide airplane hijacker and die in seconds. It was quite another to say, "Please, can I come down with smallpox?" Your clever operational mastermind might try to convince his volunteers that smallpox was like chickenpox, another annoying little rash, not to worry, plunge your hand right in. But even your stupidest volunteer would wonder how a little rash and a little fever added up to a weapon of mass destruction. Mrs. Abrams sat down next to Mitty. A paragraph from one of his antique books spun in front of his mind. It was an observation by some famous old English guy named Macaulay. Smallpox, wrote Macaulay, was always present in England. Church graveyards were full of smallpox corpses. Anybody who hadn't already gotten sick was tormented with the constant fear of getting sick. Anybody who had survived was marked forever. A mother shuddered at the sight of her own darling baby. The face of an adored girlfriend was an object of horror to her lover. A viral mist seemed to fall between Mitty and Mrs. Abrams. Her face seemed to spurt pustules, as the virus boiling beneath her skin made her bubble. "Mitty," she said, as if from a great distance, "what topic have you chosen?"
"Smallpox," he said thickly.
"Mitty, wake up! I am your English teacher. Do not tell me what your biology project is. What topic have you chosen for your term paper for me?"
Mitty chose not to think about the fact that he had yet another paper to worry about. He strolled into biology and handed his smallpox report to Mr. Lynch.
"You've written it?" said Mr. Lynch suspiciously. "You're done? You did it early?"
Even eager academic types like Olivia never did anything early. Early was weird. Or cheating. "I'm not completely done," said Mitty. "I'm just mostly done." The assignment, said Mr. Lynch, was 10 pages of notes. I specifically wanted notes. If Mitty said his notes were at home, he'd have to produce them. If he said they were in his laptop, he'd have to print them. So Mitty tried to look innocent, but puzzled by this bizarre emphasis on notes. Mr. Lynch looked down at Mitty's writing, eyebrows raised in classic teacher skepticism. Plagiarism was a problem in school. It was so easy to download whatever you needed. Teachers had websites for checking on plagiarism, but there was way too much out there to check everything. Mitty was well-liked. Nobody wanted him to turn out to be a cheat, and nobody wanted him caught if he was one. His classmates looked down at their desks while Mr. Lynch sighed. He could not avoid dealing with the cheating right here and now. But Mitty knew that he had put everything into his own words, and it would read that way. No real textbook author would put, "Henderson's guys called at every single solitary house in the entire country once a month to see if anybody had smallpox. They really and truly knocked on the doors of 120 million houses." Authors would be like, "With impressive fortitude, the multitudinous staff of the eradication team shouldered the Herculean task of..." Mr. Lynch read silently. Then he went back to the beginning of Mitty's report and proceeded to read it out loud. Mitty hoped the class wouldn't be asked to comment. "Whatever anybody says," he thought, "I won't rework a single sentence. I'm sick of this topic. It got under my skin." Mitty suppressed a shiver. What smallpox did, of course, was get under the skin. He had a memory, complete with touch and smell. He saw himself pouring smallpox scabs into his palm, the scab disintegrating between his fingers, the dust wafting, his hand rubbing his nose, his chest rising in a deep breath. A breath full of dust. Smallpox dust.
"Mitty, this is good work," said Mr. Lynch, visibly stunned that anything Mitty did might be good and also include work. "I think your writing has too much slang, but I'll let you keep it. It's definitely your own voice. Now, three more topics, Mitty. First, bioterrorism. Smallpox is at the top of the list of feared viruses. Second, find out about the supply of smallpox vaccine prepared for the nation as a result of 9/11. Third, investigate possible future use or misuse of smallpox."
"Smallpox doesn't exist," protested Thomas, a normally silent member of the class.
"It doesn't exist in the population," agreed Mr. Lynch, "but if terrorists, sophisticated terrorists, obviously with outstanding laboratories and lots of money, got hold of the virus, then what?"
He handed the paper back to Mitty.
Emma said, "I have this question about tetanus, the alternative medicine sites. They say you shouldn't get inoculated against tetanus because tetanus doesn't exist anymore. I thought the bacteria were still lying around, though, waiting for you."
"You are correct. The sources you cite are unscientific," Mr. Lynch told Emma. "If you have a deep cut from something filthy, you could get tetanus unless you've been inoculated. The disease is gone because of inoculation, not because the bacteria is gone."
What is tetanus again?" asked Thomas. Mitty was grateful not to be the only guy who couldn't keep track of bacteria and viruses.
"It used to be called lockjaw because your face muscles freeze," said Emma. "You die when the disease hits the muscles that expand your lungs. Your diaphragm seizes up and you suffocate."
Everybody was very proud of the way their own personal infectious disease killed people. People who hadn't chosen killer diseases were sorry, especially Melanie and her corn blight. Zora said importantly,
"I'm doing polio. Did you know that it's back again? We got rid of it in America, and they had gotten rid of it in Africa, but it's back now in 9 countries that got slouchy about vaccinating."
Mr. Lynch had been collecting people's notes.
"Nate," he cried, "I am so impressed you did get an interview."
Nate had known all along how brilliant he was.
"My uncle is a tropical disease researcher, of course," said Nate, with the prim little smile of the successful student. "And he's very, very, very close friends with the premier researcher on Lassa fever. I've been emailing her, and she's been very responsive to my needs."
"Poor woman must regret the invention of email," muttered Derek. Mr. Lynch raved about the research levels to which Nate was now soaring. The class favored Nate with looks of loathing.
Olivia, unusually for her, was not contributing. She was silently braiding her long dark hair. Then she began writing in one of her many notebooks. Mitty knew very few people, no boys, who liked writing by hand. Guys did everything on computers. But Olivia never traveled without paper and pencil. Her handwriting was neat, no matter how quickly she wrote, and she never misspelled. Mitty was the reverse. His handwriting was terrible, no matter how slowly he wrote, and he misspelled pretty much everything. Class was about two-thirds over. Mitty often set his watch to keep track of how much endurance he needed to live through the rest of a class. 16 more minutes. Mitty reached into his backpack, pulled out the Koplow book, and went to the index, thinking that he would skip listening to Mr. Lynch and get the research for another topic over with. Mitty looked up vaccine. Sure enough, on page 28, the author said that after the September 11 attacks, the administration was worried about other possible terrorist moves and wanted to be prepared with enough smallpox vaccine for everybody in America. At first, the U.S. couldn't come up with enough vaccine. There was zero market for it. So there were zero manufacturers. But Koplow wrote, Aventis Pasteur, a French vaccine-making company, discovered a previously overlooked inventory of 85 million doses of vaccine, housed in its Pennsylvania warehouse, and donated it to the U.S. government. Mitty was totally distracted. You could overlook 85 doses of something, maybe 85,000, but where were you looking that you didn't spot 85 million of something? Just how sloppy was your inventory anyway? Had those 85 million doses been in abandoned Pennsylvania refrigerators, forgotten even by the cleaning lady? Had some little sign on the freezer door fallen off? Had somebody once picked up a piece of paper that said 85 million smallpox doses and said to himself, "Oh, this is nothing," and thrown out the label? But why manufacture a vaccine you never gave to anybody? If you didn't get vaccinated, what was the point of having this vaccine? Didn't it exist to prevent disease? Class was over. Everybody but Mitty was leaving. Olivia paused at his side. He was planning to ask what she'd been writing that was so important that she had made no definitive contribution to classroom discussion. But when he looked at her, her lovely complexion seemed to model and split, like with Mrs. Abrams, bubbling and crusting. He was having disease hallucinations. He concentrated on shrugging his shoulders into his backpack and somehow made it into the hall with everybody else. When he looked up again, Olivia was normal, though with a slightly sad expression. "How's Typhoid Mary?" he asked. Olivia lit up. "It's a strange story, very seductive." "Seductive?" said Emma. "I'm being drawn into it," Olivia explained. "I think about typhoid all the time. I think about the disease, about the woman who gave it to other people, the men who pursued her, the prison she lived in."
"I'm doing bubonic plague," said Madeline sadly. "And every paragraph I read, I feel under my arms to see if my lymph nodes are swollen."
Mitty was cheered. Maybe they were all being drawn into their diseases. Maybe Zora, who had polio, was feeling her legs wither, while Emma, who had tetanus, was having difficulty chewing. He just needed to clarify one little point.
"So, Mr. Lynch," he yelled back into the classroom, "can a vaccine be used after a person gets sick?"
Mr. Lynch's next class piled to the door, as if getting to the same old desk in the same old room mattered more than anything on earth. Olivia got shoved sideways, and Mitty looked around for the offender to sock him.
"Look it up, Mitty," yelled Mr. Lynch. "It'll come under the heading of treatment."
Mitty had hated this kind of response since third grade, when he couldn't spell one word in a row, never mind two, and the teacher would trill, "Look it up in the dictionary, Mitty." And Mitty would trudge to this obnoxiously thick book. Little did he know it was actually a skinny beginner dictionary, and the real horror of dictionaries was yet to come, and aimlessly jab at its contents.
"I'm going back to the medical school library again today," said Olivia. "Want to come?"
"No," said Mitty. "Let's go to a movie." In Mitty's family, the call of a theater could be heard loud and clear at any hour of any day. But Olivia's family had rules. Movies were for Friday and Saturday, the assigned evenings of recreation for the Clarks. Olivia went alone to the medical school library. Mitty headed for the movie theater to distract himself, because there was something he didn't want to think about. Three words circled over and over through Mitty's mind, like a digital sign on a building in Times Square. "You handled smallpox," said the sign. In spite of Mr. Lynch's instructions, Mitty didn't have to look anything up. He already knew. The medical responder's handbook had had a section on smallpox treatment. A short section. Because there is none. Chapter 6. Mitty Blake stood on Broadway at 68th reading movie titles on the marquee. For the first time he could remember, it didn't matter if he never saw any of them. The wind chewed on his bare ankles. He seriously had to consider wearing socks for the rest of February. He warmed himself up with a coffee from a street vendor. The coffee didn't go down. He had to lunge at his own throat to make the swallow happen. Great, he thought. I not only have symptoms of my own disease, but now I'm getting symptoms of everybody else's disease. I should destroy that envelope. My mother is going to sell some poor slob a nice little library, and when they put it on the shelf, they'll find... He was being a jerk. The envelope held dust, not disease. Mitty flicked his coffee cup into a trash barrel and headed home. Probably because he was in a hurry, he ended up having to speak to everybody in his entire building. Jed, the doorman, Brandy, the weekday concierge, Henry, the mailman. Then Mitty bumped into Felix, who stored all the packages delivered to all 700 tenants and had to ask how his operation had gone and even listen to the details. He had to welcome home the opera singer from her performances in Italy and pat her white terrier, squat down and make faces at the 2-year-old twins Ashton and Avery, for whom he had once babysat and decided that once was enough when it came to babysitting, and also tell their nanny how great her new hair color looked. Then he had to get into an argument with Nick and maintenance over whether UConn was capable of beating Duke. The result was, Mitty felt pretty normal by the time he reached the 8th floor and let himself into the apartment. He strode into his bedroom, planning to squash the envelope like a cockroach. Not that they had roaches in this building. They probably used enough insecticide here to blanket all 5 boroughs. But there were no antique books in Mitty's room. Had his mother come in and taken them? Sold them? It's okay, he said to himself. The envelope never mattered anyhow. He was so thirsty that his tongue felt like corduroy. People who got smallpox, he thought, how did they stay hydrated when they were so sick? There were no IVs back then, so they weren't getting water intravenously. Plus, their mouths were full of sores. Every swallow must have been brutal. And everybody else was just as sick as you, so it wasn't as if your family was hovering over the bed with glasses of water helping you sip. He was still shivering. His pulse was up. Mitty slammed into his father's study and approached the big Webster's Dictionary, his least favorite bound pages in the world. He looked up that stupid symptom, rigor. The 4th meaning was shivering or trembling, as in the chill preceding a fever. This is what happens when you do your homework, Mitty decided. It makes you sick. He went into the kitchen to get a soda. Mitty could understand the theory behind school. Every citizen had to read and write, but he had conquered reading and writing in elementary school and did not want to hone his skills. Everybody said that USA Today was written on a 6th-grade level, and since Mitty could totally cruise through the sports section, why go on? He yearned to quit school. How could they ask him not only to write a huge biology paper, but also to write an English paper, and read Beowulf, and do his math, and world history, in which offhand he couldn't remember what continent they were studying right now, never mind what century? Mitty frowned. That was 4 subjects. Wasn't he taking 5? He pulled the pop tab on a can of Pepsi, wishing he had gone to the medical library with Olivia. There were several aspects of his disease he wanted to look up. It isn't my disease, he yelled, and you don't need a treatment for it because it doesn't exist. He had a sudden vision involving towels. Almost blushing, he walked back into his bedroom. Yes, after his morning shower, he had draped his wet towel over a handy stack of books. Mitty had never gotten into the whole yoga zen thing where you solved your anxiety with deep breathing and peaceful thoughts. He preferred action, so he kicked the books under his bed, 1 at a time, and hard. They could live in the dark indefinitely, because the maid refused to clean under there. Mitty went online and wandered around on the CDC site again, ignoring its little sidebars filled with warnings and its little hotlines for consulting staff if you perceived an emergency. They didn't use Mitty's favorite phrase, hot agent. Lethal incurable disease was their term. Then he went to the site run by the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, abbreviated USAMRIID, and pronounced USAMRID, which ran Maximum Containment Laboratories. There was something very comforting about USAMRID. These were Americans who knew what they were doing, as opposed to Mitty, an American who did not have the slightest idea what he was doing, other than getting the shakes over homework. That was when you knew you had bottomed out. Mitty decided to look up North Brother Island instead of do homework. Those people who arranged walking tours in New York City, Lower East Side walks, Jazz in Harlem walks, mystery book walks, could probably arrange a Typhoid Mary walk. That would be a terrific present for Olivia. Mitty happened to know that Valentine's Day was coming up. He knew this because his mother began mentioning holidays weeks ahead of time, giving his dad time to close in on a gift and arrange a celebration. Approximately 48 hours prior to the special day, it was Mitty's job to ask Dad whether he was ready, because if he failed, Mom would kill him again this year. It dawned on Mitty that if New York City had a typhoid hospital, it must have had a smallpox hospital, and if they isolated typhoid on an island, wouldn't they also isolate smallpox on an island? He loved online research, and he was good at it, so it took only a minute to find that the island was Roosevelt in the East River, and that the smallpox hospital, although in ruins, still existed. Mitty threw on a jacket and left the building. He had a great digital camera, but didn't remember it until he was on Broadway, so he stopped at Duane Reade to buy a disposable one. Not too shabby, thought Mitty, ripping off the cardboard. For my disease, I'll have a mummified body part and photographs of a historic hospital. Why would a doctor save scabs anyway? Pathologists save stuff like diseased liver slices or brain tissue to study later in a lab. Had a doctor, back in 1902, planned to study those scabs, and then forgotten about them? Or died of smallpox himself before he could do anything? Perhaps there were still things to learn from those scabs, in which case some scientist or physician would love to have a look at Mitty's variola major remains. I could go one better than some lousy interview like Nate's, Mitty thought. I'm the owner, so I can make those scientists beg and plead. Maybe he would design a website. He'd call it Got Scabs. That would attract some attention. Probably not from the right people, though, because that was the thing about the internet. The wrong people were there, too. Derek had websites of his own and would definitely help design Got Scabs, or even take over the whole project. But no matter how much work Derek did, it would still mean work for Mitty, and so Mitty rejected the idea. He jogged across Central Park, passing the softball diamonds with their tattered winter look and the carousel building, shuttered and sad. He cut across traffic near the Plaza Hotel, where even in this weather, a few tough horses were giving carriage rides. He had never taken the tram ride to Roosevelt Island, even though he always meant to, because in Spider-Man there was a great scene involving the tram. The tram was waiting on its platform. When it was docked, there was nothing exciting about it. Mitty swiped his Metro card and boarded. Gloomily, he perceived that there was going to be nothing exciting anyway. It was just a box with windows on a cable. Besides, Spider-Man had been filmed at night, when anything could be made mysterious. A lot of the other riders knew each other, the population of Roosevelt being pretty small. There were mothers with strollers, shoppers with bags, old guys looking mournful, and four little boys who, if they were with a grown-up, were ignoring that person. There was a dramatic mix of races, probably because the United Nations building was across the river from the island. So UN people were likely to think of living on Roosevelt Island, whereas regular people cringed at the thought of being forced to live off Manhattan. The tram moved slowly and without bumps. For a minute, Mitty had an outstanding view in all directions. He looked down at the rough currents of the East River and the heavy car traffic on the Queensboro Bridge, and then they were down. Everyone else got on a little bus. So Mitty did too. Roosevelt Island faced a boring part of Manhattan. Mitty had not known there was such a thing. He went into what looked like the only grocery store in town to buy some Advil and a bottle of water. He was beginning to worry about the number of headaches he was having. The clerk told him where to find the smallpox hospital ruins on the southern tip of the island. Mitty walked back, passing the tram station, and then a long-term hospital still in use, with that hunkered-down look of institutions in winter. Cars were parked everywhere, which puzzled him, until he realized that from the other direction, Queens, there must be a car bridge. Roosevelt had exactly one road, the island being too skinny to fit two roads, and not a single car was being driven. Not a single person was walking, either, although it was so cold, it might just have been that everybody except Mitty had a brain. The pedestrian path along the East River came to a sudden eerie halt at an extraordinarily high chain-link fence topped with rolls of slicing wire. Bolted to the fence were huge no-trespassing signs. There was even a call box in case you needed cops. The smallpox hospital ruins were kept behind this? They didn't even want people near the building? After all these years? Mitty took another Advil. So the CDC could say what it wanted, but in real life, New York City didn't want human beings touching the very walls where smallpox had once lived. The last case in the United States had been in 1949. Was New York City still worried, almost six decades later? Then he saw that there was a door in the fence, padlocked, open. Mitty was disappointed, having hoped to test his Spider-Man skills by scaling 12 feet of chain link covered with razor wire. He walked between low chain link to keep him safe from the East River and high chain link with more no trespassing signs. Darkness was closing in. The ugly grounds and the rough water, the lowering clouds and the shadows blended into one grim tapestry. Against the dusky sky, he saw Gothic towers with windowless arches. His pace slowed. Trees grew inside the walls. The turrets were separating, trying to collapse, the way patients must have collapsed in smallpox agony. The hospital ruins were beyond hope, like smallpox victims. Mitty felt as if he'd been thinking about smallpox for a century. He took two photographs of the Gothic remains, and a blast of light enveloped him. He was blinded, like a deer about to be poached. Mitty flung an arm up to shade his eyes and ward off the enemy, but it was just floodlights coming on automatically to silhouette the romantic crumbling stones against the darkening sky. It looked like a movie setting. It was a movie setting. It was where Spider-Man and the Green Goblin fought to the death in the final confrontation. Mitty started laughing. He was so glad there had been no witness. Mitty Blake, scared of electricity. So glad he had not said out loud that New York City still had fences to prevent the spread of smallpox, when in fact it had fences to keep movie fans from spidering up and down ruins that could fall on top of them and kill them. His cell phone rang and he answered, still laughing. It was his mother. Mitty didn't tell her that he was exploring little islands alone in the dark. She chattered excitedly about her day, and they discussed dinner while Mitty headed back to the tram. She made her phone kiss sound, and Mitty phone kissed back and boarded. Olivia had left him a text message. Productive afternoon at the library. Am now walking past the nursing school, about to get on subway. The tram reached the peak of its short trip, where for one moment there was a spectacular view in each direction as Manhattan lit up for the night. Mitty loved Olivia's courage. It was not fashionable to have a productive afternoon at a library. It was not chic to thrive on knowledge. How easily the other girls could turn on Olivia. How readily the guys could scorn her. He thought of how she sat at the front of a classroom where even Mitty, who liked her, would not go. She was there so she didn't have to see the contempt on the faces of those to whom school was a stupid waste of time. And so was Olivia. He hoped that the girl who had once been Bunny would never get trumped on, especially by him. But he didn't know how to say that. So instead, he called her and said, "Why'd you mention nursing school? You want to be a nurse?"
"No, that was a geographical detail. I wouldn't be good at nursing. I'm not actually that fond of individual people."
Mitty loved people. It was why he loved New York. All those people. He could watch anyone in New York and be satisfied. He loved their expressions and hairstyles and dogs, their tattoos and t-shirt slogans. Mitty's great skill was making friends. He was friends with doormen, janitors, pretzel vendors, and police officers. He was friends with the jocks and the zeros, with people standing in line for coffee or movie tickets. He loved listening to other people's cell phone conversations. He loved what people would say out loud. When they spoke some other language and he couldn't listen in, he felt deprived.
He was taking Spanish not because colleges required foreign language, but so he wouldn't miss out on conversations that didn't include him. Spanish! That was his fifth subject. Mitty felt better now that he'd remembered.
I want research, Olivia was saying. Medical, historical, or both. Right now, I'm interested in the concept of quarantine. That was the only medical recourse for thousands of years, but there are moral problems with how they handled Mary Mallon.
He could not think of another girl who would dare use disturbing words like moral in conversation with a boy she liked. When Olivia descended into the subway, Mitty lost her signal, so he called his father.
I didn't see you this morning, said his father regretfully. And I won't get home until you're asleep.
His dad worked for an international firm, where everybody was happy to have one guy willing to hang out in the office at night for calls from the West Coast and Japan.
I'll be up working on my term paper, Mitty told him.
Guess what, Dad? Mr. Lynch thinks the first half is outstanding. His father had wanted to hear these words for a long time.
I want to read it, he said eagerly.
Mitty got off the phone. He was shivering again. It was not from cold. He had not yet mentioned the scabs to anybody, even Olivia. He had not written about it. He had visualized a clear plastic sleeve into which he would drop the envelope so he could include it with his report. But now he wasn't so sure. The thought of his father touching that envelope made Mitty shiver again. I know it isn't dangerous, he thought. But what if it is?
Koplau, page 49. Hostile forces, covertly controlled by unrepentant national authorities, or by rogue elements that operate independently of effective centralized governmental direction, may have stashed variola stocks, despite their country's overt acceptance of the Biological Weapons Convention and despite any WHO action. It is also possible that other laboratories may continue to house variola repositories, more by accident than by design, poorly labeled, inadequately inventoried, and long forgotten, but still viable. If Mitty used language like that, Mr. Lynch would totally know he was copying. So Mitty wrote, If your country is run by bad guys, or if you have gangs of bad guys who aren't running your country, but they're powerful, they might have smallpox, even if their actual government claims they don't. And if your laboratory is second rate, you could have smallpox around that you forgot about.
Tucker, page 138. In 1992, a high-ranking Soviet official defected to the United States and gave the U.S. intelligence community some chilling news. He reported that in parallel with the global WHO campaign to eradicate smallpox, an effort in which Soviet virologists, epidemiologists, and vaccine manufacturers had played a leading role, the Soviet military had cynically pursued a top-secret program to transform the virus into a doomsday weapon. They came up with a way to keep the virus in dried egg powder, which gave it a significantly longer shelf life. They also put it in aerosol form, which made it extremely stable. Mitty reflected on this. So a virus was happy, so far as a virus had emotions, in a freezer or in egg powder. How happy was a virus in an envelope? And what did extremely stable mean? That it could still infect? And could it still infect just the following day? Or even 100 years later? As to rogue states, it seemed to Mitty that scientists there would sell their knowledge, or virus, to the highest bidder. That guy in Pakistan just last week admitted he'd been selling nuclear weapons knowledge all over the globe. And what did their president, Musharraf, say? Don't worry about it. What's a little top-secret info between friends? Or even enemies? If a government could shrug like that about nuclear weapons, they'd shrug about missing smallpox virus, because it was a disease nobody remembered anyway, and thought was just a skin problem. That morning, the librarian had been lying in wait for Mitty, holding out yet another book, Smallpox as a Biological Weapon, and several weeks' worth of U.S. News and World Report. Cornered, Mitty had read enough for the current events section of his paper. Whether to keep our smallpox stash is a big argument in the science community. Some people want to destroy it all. They say we know the DNA sequences, so why risk restarting the disease? And besides, we need to set a good example for rogue countries. But some people want to keep the virus. They say, what if smallpox comes back? Then we need our virus supply to make the vaccine again.
Plus, the thing about rogue countries is that they don't care about good examples. Rogue states and rogue people want a universal killer to spew all over the world. In fact, you don't have to be very rogue. There are plenty of hate-filled, half-insane countries who claim to be non-rogue and are still in the United Nations pretending to care about peace. Then finally, there's the Save Our Smallpox bumper sticker crowd. They don't think we should extinguish a living creature. Mitty certainly had no problem extinguishing the creature that was smallpox. He dug out his DVD to watch Spider-Man. His father found him asleep under a pile of books and papers, his laptop having put itself to sleep too, the remains of a snack spilling gently off a tilted plate, while Spider-Man leaped across spurning rafters. Mitty's father turned off the DVD and tucked a blanket around his sleeping son. It had now been 4 days since Mitchell John Blake had inhaled the particles of a smallpox scab. Chapter 7. That night, Mitty had smallpox dreams. He woke up sweating and shivering, unable to catch his breath or slow his heartbeat. He was lying on the bare floor of his bedroom, like a prisoner in a cell. Of course, it was a really well-furnished cell, with great electronics. In the entire world, he thought, I am the only person dreaming of smallpox. The apartment was always hot. The Blakes rarely turned on the heat, even on the coldest days, because the building was so warm from all the apartments that did have their heat on. But even in bed, under blankets, Mitty could not get warm. He lay staring, wide-eyed at the ceiling as if he had lockjaw of the eyelids. Facts and fears slammed into him like so many tennis balls lobbed into his face. He was still awake at 3 a.m.
Mitty Blake! Screamed his mother. It's 9:44!
Mitty dragged himself out of sleep. He hoped it was a Saturday.
The school just called, Mitty. You promised you would never cut school again.
He huddled under the blankets.
I'm not actually cutting, Mom. I just didn't wake up.
Smallpox, he thought. I had smallpox. Mom had it. Dad had it.
Mitty!
She cried. A major rant about his shortcomings was about to begin.
Now, Kathleen, yelled his father from the other end of the apartment. It wasn't intentional. Mitty didn't...
Mitty had to be careful of events like this. His parents had radically different ideas about how to treat Mitty's failures, and might battle each other instead of him. So Mitty said quickly, I was a jerk, Mom. I forgot to set my alarm. I can get dressed in a second and be at school in 10 minutes, okay?
Is this going to happen again?
His mother demanded, as if Mitty had chosen strip mining national parks for a career.
It happened once last fall, Mom, he said, and once now, therefore my failure to wake up rate is actually one morning per semester, so yeah, it might well happen again, possibly as early as May, probably not till next September.
She didn't laugh as she left his room. Mitty slid down from the top bunk and landed on an annoying assortment of books and papers. He put only his laptop into his backpack.
Orange juice,
shouted his mother from the other end of the apartment.
Socks!
Mitty surrendered on both fronts. Love you, Mom, he said, kissing her goodbye. She melted. She always did. He hugged her again for good measure and tore out of the apartment. He was halfway to school when he